we miss the market, we may be looking at about $5 million less.
The federal government shutdown threatens the lucrative Bering Sea crab fishery. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, 90-year-old Lowell Thomas talks about his adventures, including traveling around the world with his wife.
We wanted to have this personal adventure of flying around the world as much as we could, but also to make it pay off in the end, make it our work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Fishermen are gearing up for the start of the Bering Sea's lucrative crab season, but they may be off to a late start this year because of the federal government shutdown. The National Marine Fisheries Service is supposed to divide up the crab and assign individual fishing quotas, or IFQs, to boats. Right now, though,
there's nobody on staff with National Marine Fisheries Service available to issue IFQs, as they are furloughed.
That's Heather Fitch. She's a state biologist with Fish and Game. Fitch says it's illegal for boats to harvest crab without these permits. But there's no way of knowing how long it will be before the government gets around to issuing them.
Either someone would have to be authorized to come back to work in order to do so, or it'll wait until the federal government is up and running again.
NIMF's Law Enforcement Division is one of the few departments that's still open. A NIMF's enforcement officer says they're trying to figure out a solution. As a compromise, they may let crab boats put their pots in the water before they get their permits, as long as they don't pull up any crab. Jake Jacobson is the executive director for the Intercooperative Exchange, a co-op of 80 crab boats. He says it's never good to leave crab pots unattended. But on the other hand, Jacobson says fishermen can't afford to start late.
If there is a delay, we're at risk of not being able to land our crab in time to reach the all-important Asian New Year's market.
Last season, the co-op tried to get most of its fishing done in the first 3 weeks of the season so they could send their crab overseas to the Japanese market. Jacobson says they wanted to do that again this year.
We missed the market. We may be looking at about $5 million less.
The Bering Sea crab fisheries are supposed to open on October 15th. When the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas last met, the theme was overreach from Washington. But this go-round, it seems the group is inadvertently dealing with federal underreach. Because of the government shutdown, none of the federal employees scheduled to address the commission this week have been able to appear. The irony hasn't been lost on the group when Craig Fleener, a deputy commissioner with the Department of Fish and Game, let the commission know that hunts could still take place at parks, but any activity that needed paperwork couldn't be done. The reaction was almost gleeful. Here's Representative Les Keller, a Republican from Wasilla, who serves on the commission.
Another way to say that is maybe our parks are more open to us Alaskans than they ever have been.
Wide open, as long as you don't need a permit.
Hunting on refuges might be a different story. Governor Sean Parnell has called for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to lift closures on those lands. While nobody who works for the federal government has been able to speak, the commission did hear from a person who is aspiring to a job in Washington. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, who is one of the Republican candidates for Senate, laid out his goals for federal land management this morning. He reiterated his support for opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas and his opposition to a national oceans policy. He said he would like to see a transfer of more federal land to the state and progress on federal revenue sharing. And Treadwell also said that when dealing with the federal government, Alaska should not be afraid to invoke the 10th Amendment, which has been used in legal challenges over state sovereignty.
And the 10th Amendment says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or the people. And long live the 10th Amendment, and long live courts that are beginning to give it justice and attention.
The Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas will continue to meet through tomorrow. While the group does not have any regulatory authority, it will be presenting recommendations to the legislature on how the state should manage its relationship with the federal government when it comes to land use issues. Alaska's High Court became the first state Supreme Court in the country yesterday to hear an appeal in one of more than a dozen climate change lawsuits. The lawsuits pit young people against their states. The plaintiffs claim the state has an obligation to protect the atmosphere from excessive carbon emissions. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has the story.
Nelson Canuck is a freshman at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the main plaintiff in Alaska's case. His family's home in the 600-person village of Kipnuk became uninhabitable because of spring floods, melting permafrost, and erosion. This summer, his parents, two brothers, and three sisters moved to Bethel, about 100 miles away.
We're thinking of hopefully rebuilding a home in Kipnuk, or we might move out of town to possibly Kenai or somewhere where we can start over.
The state has three main arguments for why the court should dismiss his case. Climate change is a political question that only lawmakers and the governor can address, not the courts. The injury to these youths from climate change is so ubiquitous that they don't have legal standing. And finally, the atmosphere, unlike, say, clean water, isn't a public trust resource that the state has a legal obligation to protect. The science of climate change was not disputed. Assistant Attorney General Seth Bosang argued the case for the state.
My argument is not that nothing can be done to stop global warming. It's just that it shouldn't happen in the context of a lawsuit. Where I think it should happen is at the political level. So if people are concerned about climate change, you know, they should get involved. And, you know, we live in a democracy, and you should get as involved as you possibly can.
While it's not up to the court to write policy, attorney for the plaintiffs Brad DeNoble argues it is the court's role to compel the state to come up with policy.
You can declare the constitutional rights. You can declare that the atmosphere is a public trust resource. You can order the state to develop an accounting.
Similar lawsuits are pending in 12 other states, federal court, even Ukraine and Uganda. That's according to Julia Olson, director of Our Children's Trust. Her Oregon-based nonprofit helped Canuck and other young people file these suits. So far, Olson says only a trial court in Texas has backed the plaintiffs. Texas filed an appeal. Alaska Chief Justice Dana Fabe didn't give a timetable for when to expect a decision. Opinions typically come months after arguments are heard. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The state of Alaska has ordered a review of the Fairbanks 4 case. The Department of Law announced the move yesterday, saying new information in the 1997 murder of John Hartman led to the decision. Last week, the Alaska Innocence Project filed requests for post-conviction relief for Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, Eugene Vent, and George Freeze, the Fairbanks men convicted of and now serving long prison terms for the attack on Hartman. The applications include a letter from a former Fairbanks resident serving life in prison for other murders who claims a different group of men carried out the attack. The state announcement says there has been no credible allegation about the integrity of the original investigation. It says the Alaska state enforcement agencies, including state troopers and Fairbanks police, are in support of the review. The state is requesting additional time beyond the 45 days it has under law to conduct the review and respond to the requests for post-conviction relief. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the strange job of moving an entire museum worth of stuff.
Right now I've got a bag that has a wing in it from a taxidermied bird, and I know that through this process I'm eventually going to find a bird with one wing, and we're going to reunite the bird with its wing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A piece of equipment installed a few years ago near Dillingham has helped detect a small explosive event at the faraway Cleveland volcano in the Aleutian Islands. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Cleveland volcano is among the most active volcanoes in Alaska, but it is not monitored using seismic sensors placed on or around the volcano. Such seismic networks are stationed on several volcanoes in the state. Dave Schneider is with the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
We had a small explosion that was detected by sensors in Dillingham and also at a couple other nearby volcanoes. And these sensors actually look at a pressure wave that is produced by explosions that that travels sort of the speed of sound and is recorded by those sensors. In terms of what's going on there, you know, that's hard to say. We don't have really many direct observations of Cleveland. We do know that these kinds of explosions have happened relatively frequently over the past several years. There's probably 20 to 30 of them that have occurred, but none of them have produced much of an ash cloud to really be detected in the satellite data.
The small explosive event was detected at 4:24 Wednesday morning, and it's the first explosive event detected at the Cleveland volcano since May. Schneider confirms that the volcano alert level will remain unchanged. It's currently at alert level advisory.
Explosion and not necessarily indicative of overall increase in activity. So we'll continue to watch Cleveland with the resources that we have. And if we have evidence that things are ramping up there, we would increase the alert level. But at this point, our experience with the volcano is these are typically sort of one-off, very short duration events.
The Cleveland volcano is so remote that the Alaska Volcano Observatory uses remote infrasound sensors to detect small explosions. Among those sensors is a six-element infrasound array located near Dillingham that's operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Schneider says the array has been an extremely valuable tool for detecting explosions at distant volcanoes.
In some ways, it's almost like someone going in and getting an MRI and seeing things that they never saw before. So, it could be that this has been the typical activity at Cleveland for many, many years, but only in the past several have we been able to detect it since we have a sort of new ways of looking at the data.
Last year, Schneider co-authored a research paper that looked at the effectiveness of infrasound arrays in detecting hidden volcanic explosions at the Cleveland volcano. In that paper, the authors note that the successful results of the investigation provide motivation for expanded efforts in infrasound monitoring across the Aleutians. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The list of Alaskans with notable adventures is long, but Lowell Thomas Jr.'s accomplishments are impressive by any standard. A former 12-year state senator and lieutenant governor, an author, filmmaker, and world traveler who visited the Dalai Lama and desert nomads. Thomas has logged more than 10,000 hours flying, much of it in a single-engine airplane with his wife, Tay, as his navigator. A new book, co-authored with Lou Friedman, chronicles Lowell Thomas Jr.'s amazing life and is out now, just a few days before his 90th birthday. Lowell and Tay tell us with so many adventures, it's tough to pick a highlight.
The one that comes to mind right now, just I don't know why we were talking about it, just amongst ourselves, was the time that we were flying our own airplane, a Cessna 180, in Africa. And we took the first pygmy who'd ever been up in an airplane, took him up with us, and he just had a ball. He loved it. And so that was something to really remember over the years.
The trip that the two of you took around the world for your honeymoon, tell us about that. What year that was and what kind of a plane you were in, because it seems like that was long enough ago that seems like a pretty monumental trip to take to go around the world in a small plane. Tell us about the logistics of that and how long it took.
Well, that would have been back, in about 1951 that we took off on that trip?
No,
54, that's right.
Actually, it wasn't a honeymoon trip. It was 4 years after we were married. We had... We traveled ever since we were married. We traveled a lot, but it was always on airlines. And we got tired of airline flying and got tired of seeing big cities all around the world. So?
Well, we wanted to have this personal adventure of flying around the world as much as we could. but also to make it pay off in the end, make it our work. So it was a fine combination, and it worked extremely well. We spent most of our time in Africa, as I recall, and in our own little plane, we didn't go all the way around, did we, dear?
We went across the deserts in the north, and then we went through the jungles in the middle part of Africa, and then up again to the deserts. And my father knew Charles Lindbergh, and so we thought, well, we'll go talk to him and get him some advice from him as to what we should and shouldn't do with a little plane in that area of Africa and the Middle East. So we went up to talk to him one night, and he was very interested and urged us on, but he said, just one thing I want to tell you, don't spend too much time over water.
Seems like sound advice.
In a single engine plane, yeah.
Well, that sounds like an amazing trip. How about some of your adventures in Alaska? What are some of the most memorable trips that you've had flying right here in the state? As you, of course, well know, the weather can change very, very quickly. Things can go from great to very serious and scary in a big hurry. So what are some of the things that you've experienced as a pilot here?
Well, I think flying climbers on and off McKinley and some of the other big mountains, those are some pretty thrilling moments, more so sometimes than others, depending on the turbulence and the weather. And then flying out over the Arctic Ocean, that was always a thrilling thing to do in a single-engine airplane on wheel skis and landing on some of those ice floes. And, oh, gosh, it's hard to remember all the great times, but flying on and off the mountain glaciers, really, I think that was probably the most thrilling part of the flying experience I've ever had in Alaska, because the hazards are so great, really.
Well, it's hard to imagine with such a full and amazing life that there would be anything left on your list. But are there things that you just didn't get to in that busy life, either here in Alaska or somewhere else, that you really wanted to do?
Sure, I'd like to land on the moon. Oh, there are plenty of things that we missed doing, but we were lucky to do all those that we did.
A celebration of Lowell Thomas Jr.'s 90th birthday will be held at the Anchorage Museum tomorrow. His book, Lowell Thomas Jr., Flight to Adventure, Alaska and Beyond, is in stores now.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Shady Grove Oliver. This week on AK, museum moving. Construction workers in Juneau are building a new State Library Archives Museum. And inside the old building, a small team of museum staff and volunteers are preparing to move. They're packing up the entire collection, ranging from a 45-foot umiak to half-inch-tall ivory pieces. Only 5% of the museum's collection is displayed at any given time. The rest is stored in the basement. So KTOO's Lisa Fu took a tour of the museum basement to find out what it takes to move a museum.
As conservator for the Alaska State Museum, Ellen Carley is responsible for figuring out how to pack up more than 32,000 objects. It involves opening every drawer in every storage unit and coming up with a plan for each item.
Like this drawer, for example, has several boxes in it already, which are really easy to travel. But this drum, which is from the Arctic Winter Games, it's a walrus stomach drum from 1974, and it has signatures of people all over. It's very delicate.
Carley says she and other museum staff members pack and move objects all the time, for exhibits or to go on loan. That's part of their job description. But moving an entire collection is a once-in-a-career type of thing. There's no manual on how to pack up a museum collection. So Carley resorted to more pedestrian means. She Googled it.
If you look on the internet for good methods for packing museum artifacts, and you try to search Google Images or whatever, you'd think there would be a lot of images, but there's not nearly as many as we'd like to see.
So she's had to improvise. Carley has come up with about a dozen different techniques for packing various artifacts, including dance fans with feather appendages, ivory cribbage boards, spruce root baskets, and a 3-foot-high piece of red tree coral. She walks around the basement with a yellow legal pad, scrutinizing each artifact and writing down a plan to stabilize it. After she's gone through all the objects, she tapes her handwritten notes and diagrams to the outside of the cabinet.
Every cabinet, every drawer, every item has to have a plan.
Carley heads up a team of staff and volunteers who are tackling different aspects of the packing. On this day, museum professional John Loring is focused on ivory. He wears cotton gloves and is in the process of creating custom storage mounts for carved ivory pipes.
Ivory is one of the most fragile objects we have in the collection.
Loring sits by a table filled with cutting materials, measuring devices, a glue gun, a spool of cotton ribbon, and different size scraps of foam and cardboard.
Some of these are really complicated, and you have to cut exactly the right angle to support the object, and it's not so easy. I can probably do about 12 to 15 of these a day.
The museum has 70 ivory pipes in its collection. Loring is also making custom mounts for masks. There are 600 of those. Volunteer Fran Dameron has been helping out at the museum for 14 years. At the moment, she's putting numbers on mining artifacts.
Did you see these enormous wrenches down here? I wouldn't try to lift it. That's why I was working on the floor.
The numbers are linked to the museum's database, which keeps track of all the collection items. Carley says the process of having to look through every storage unit has helped the team locate what are called registration problems, items without a number.
This museum goes back to 1900, so we've got 113 years of potential clerical errors.
There's also the chance of finding something that was missing or two pieces that were separated.
Right now I've got a bag that has a wing in it from a taxidermied bird. And I know that through this process, I'm eventually going to find a bird with one wing and we're going to reunite the bird with its wing.
The team has until the end of February to pack up the museum's collection. Once that's all done safely and securely, Addison Field is in charge of moving the collection. The majority of it will travel in carts through a tunnel to be built between the current building and the new one. Field says other items, like paintings, may take more care. He anticipates many will need to be hand-carried.
One object and one person, and that's not the most efficient way to do things, but when you're dealing with things that are really truly treasures and need to be safeguarded, that's the safest way to do it.
And then there are the items that won't fit through the tunnel, like the 8-foot-wide, 45-foot-long walrus hide umiak, which was originally assembled inside the building. Field doesn't know how that will be moved, but what he does know is when the doors of the new State Libraries, Archives, and Museums building open in the spring of 2016, the umiak will be there, unscathed. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week on AK, we're heading to the small community of Kaufman Cove on Prince of Wales Island in Southeast.
My name is Carolyn Duncan, and I'm mayor here in Kaufman Cove, Alaska, down in Southeast on Prince of Wales Island. It did start as a logging camp, but the people who lived here became such neighbors and friends and family to each other over the years. It was a very happy camp and a very stable one. People's families started to grow up here instead of moving here and there to work, and there was a big, what we call home guard group here, who just simply wanted to stay, so they started petitioning for land, and that's what they did. Toward the end of the 90s there, the logging shut down completely, you know, between, it was beginning to do about the mid-90s, and by 2000 it was gone. And people who were then making, you know, $42,000 a year, today make $22,000 a year. So it was really had a huge economic impact. The heart of our community always has been the school. And I'm sitting right here as I speak with you in the very first schoolhouse from Kaufman Cove. It's now serving as our city hall. But the school, by which we mean the students and the teachers and the atmosphere, there is the whole thing. We went from 60 kids in a school when the logging camp was active to down to around 10 a couple of years ago. And we've worked very hard to boost morale around here and make little jobs available to people. So today I'm proud to say we have 28 students in our school. We have a beautiful view out over Clarence Strait, so about 7 miles of water. It gets to be pretty big water there. And that's what we view. We're on the east side of Prince of Wales looking toward Edelin Island there. So it's quite a beautiful view. Our big event of the year is in August. It's our Arts and Seafood Festival, and we're very, very proud of it. We worked hard to bring that on and make that a wonderful, welcoming event for people from all over. I think anyone who comes any time of the year will be struck by how friendly the people are and how much we value you coming to us.
Carolyn Duncan is the mayor of Kaufman Cove. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lisa Fu, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. Our AK guest host this week was Shady Grove Oliver. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.